In a world where action films are dumped in theaters and TV, dead on arrival.
I can't go on living this lie!
You need a hero.
Last time I trusted someone, I lost an eye.
You need a helper.
Hello, hello, nothing to see here.
You need a healer.
That is affirmative.
You need...
We're on the air.
Professor Rick's Action Film Autopsy.
Hi, everybody. And now we're going to start with there'll be spoilers. 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 We want this film to be better, so there will be spoilers. There's our theme song. And hi, I'm Rick Myers, and we finally made it to our dog days of August crammed podcast. And with me, as always, are
Nico Mai.
Jen.
Just Jen. Still Miko Mai. He's grown a last name. But oh, yeah, Jen, no. It's just Jen. There we go. So what are we going to do? We're going to do this in alphabetical order?
Not for nothing. You said dog days, implying that it was slow, but, like, there's so many.
No, dog days, you know why it's called dog days? It's because in August, when it gets so hot, mad dogs and Englishmen go out in the midday sun.
Oh.
Dogs go, when you'll see dogs out in the hot going,
oh, I get
it. You know, breathing so heavy.
I thought it was because, like, it's just hot and boring, so, like, the dogs are just sleeping around everywhere.
Well, no, they're hot. It's not boring.
Uh-huh.
No, August is not boring.
Yeah.
But anyway, I guess we'll start with the leftover from last episode a month ago.
Oh, yes.
The movie we didn't talk about because you guys hadn't seen it yet.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And I hear it is somewhat controversial amongst the three of us.
Oh, is it?
Well,
I don't know if it's controversial, but I know you liked it a lot.
I did.
I enjoyed it.
Yeah.
I enjoyed that a lot. The fact that Spider-Man has a theme song. That was awesome.
The original cartoon theme song, which was used orchestrally at the beginning of Spider-Man Homecoming.
Mm-hmm. And in the credits, which were awesome.
The cute.
The drug.
So, yes, I enjoyed it immensely. I'm a person who was there at Spider-Man number one, Amazing Fantasy 15, the comic book. Mm-hmm. So I followed Superman. I followed his career, too, but I wasn't born for his creation. But I was there at the creation of Spider-Man, the first appearance of Spider-Man. I followed him throughout his career. I had the first 50 issues of his comic book, which my mom threw out as soon as I went to college, and all sorts of other things. So, and also, I am friends with Mike Avon Oeming, who's partnered up with Brian Bendis, who did the Spider-Man Ultimate. So I've been following his career and having friends at Marvel and all the rest of it forever, since the very beginning. So seeing the movie just thrilled the crap out of me, because they were so smart. There was so much alluded to. There were so many Easter eggs for Spider-Man fans of every age. So
I'm getting it back.
And also, I thought it was exhilarating. And again, we'll get you, Jen, upset with the fact that I saw this and Baby Driver very close together.
Mm-hmm.
And I compare the two of them. And Spider-Man Homecoming has such a great ending, and yet, you know, I think Baby Driver had such a soft ending. And I use it as an example. This is how you do an ending. Spider-Man is how you do an ending. And Baby Driver was not, as far as I was concerned. So now, Miko, I'm told by you that you weren't crazy over it, Spider-Man.
No.
Why not?
Well, one of the reasons, I think it's definitely hero fatigue.
Oh.
I think it's definitely one of the reasons why, because when I was watching it, I was telling Jen right after we came out, I was like, I enjoyed the film. The film was very enjoyable. It was fun. There was a lot of action, a lot of humor in it. Great CG scenes where when the boat gets, the ferry gets destroyed.
Oh, yeah.
That was fantastic. But there's a lot of small moments where I am kind of tired of making excuses for the character. Where, like, okay, like, I for example, there's one scene where he couldn't drive and he crashed right outside the factory of what is it, Falcon? What would he call
Vulture.
It? Vulture. Okay, yeah. Vulture. Falcon is the Cap's friend. But Vulture. And then for me to sitting here and thinking, like, that would make a sound that the Vulture would know that someone was outside.
Right.
That's not believable for me.
Okay.
The other things also, I forgot what they were talking about. They were in the cab.
Yeah.
Not in the cab.
In the car, when he's driving them to the prom.
When he's driving. He immediately think of him as Spider-Man.
Yeah.
Which, for me, that's not believable, because we actually talked about it a little bit, where as soon as Vulture see that Spider-Man was in the in DC during that time, he should be there should be a scene or somewhere he trying to like isolate him as a character, like, okay, why is he in DC instead of in Queens and all of that, but none of that was there. So like, for him to speculate right away, this teenager who just happens to be wandering around DC.
Well, yeah, it's like, from that point, it's like, you know that the it's a teen from Queens, you know he's on a science decathlon team somewhere from New York, for him to be in DC during this big
I remember, I don't remember the first scene you mentioned, but I do semi-recall, when you see the movie again, because I'll get the DVD, I think you'll see that they put that in. I thought the discovery of his identity on the way to the prom was extremely well done, and I thought Michael Keaton's performance, especially.
Oh no, I think their performance was
both that
was
you know the realization when he put it all together. Because I think what you were saying he should have done, I think he did do, but he didn't do it until they were in the car. And then all of a sudden, everything started. I remember there was a specific thing that Peter Parker did or said that clued him in, or his daughter.
No, it was the daughter made a comment about him knowing Spider-Man. Yeah.
Oh, that's...
Was it?
Yeah.
Oh!
And there were some other things, too.
Yeah.
But I thought it was...
No, I remember that.
Was that... Is that... But those were... It was just those... So it's superhero fatigue.
I think for me, the part where he was trapped...
Oh,
when
yeah.
When he gets trapped in the armored car...
Yes.
I was kind of annoyed because they set up the rule of Vulture's, like the cubes that he used to create portals that let him jump into stuff.
Right.
So for me, the fact that Spider-Man jumped into the thing and then was like, hey, I'm here to fight you, like announcing himself, where it's like, why wouldn't you just sneak over and steal the cubes and trap him in the armored car? Yeah. And like, for me, that again, that's one of those things where it's like, oh, well, he's a kid and he's new, so fine. But also, like, no, why wouldn't you? For me, that was just like, they set it up and then there was never payoff with it other than him getting trapped.
So Spider-Man Homecoming was your Baby Driver.
I guess so.
Because you sound like me now with Baby Driver.
Oh, well, yeah.
Because I'm doing all these incredibly petty little things.
Yeah.
Because the movie in general, let me quickly tell people, because this is what we do. John Watts, who's best known for doing the Onion News Network and a movie in 2015 called Cop Car, directed it.
Wow.
And it was written by, and this was hilarious to me, because usually most movie companies try to cover up the number of people who worked on the screenplay.
Mm-hmm.
They usually like to say, only two or three people. But here they had listed not only John Watts as one of the writers, but Jonathan Goldstein and John Francis Daly, who are responsible for Horrible Bosses, too, and Christopher Ford, who worked with John Watts on Cop Car, then Chris McKenna and Eric Summers, who did the Lego Batman and the Community television show, among other things. So you saw where everybody was coming from and what they were trying to do.
Mm-hmm.
But another thing I really loved about it, because you might have had superhero fatigue, well, I had action scene fatigue.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't until Spider-Man Homecoming, well, not only do they have that wonderful little, now I'm expecting it, Marvel moment of kung fu at the end. Everybody's doing martial arts until the very end, when suddenly the hero goes, wait a minute, I can do this better, I can do this smarter, and he saves the villain at the end.
Mm-hmm.
He tries to make his enemy his friend, because he's not going to let him die. Well, many other heroes would. Previous Spider-Men probably would.
Would have, yeah.
Yeah, but he didn't.
Sure.
And the action in the movie, I thought, was, again, not as tight as it could have been.
I don't agree with that, though. Tobey Maguire's Spider-Man.
I feel like the first movie, he would have let him live. But by the second one, I don't think...
The first one, the main villain was his best friend's father.
Yeah,
and then the second one,
was
the villain, his mentor.
Right. So yeah,
If he was in this film, I don't know, after like the first three film of him, like the arc of him, I don't think if he is the Spider-Man here, I don't think he would let him.
I don't count the third film in the Tobey Maguire. I don't count any of the Andrew Garfield ones.
Mm-hmm.
But the action was good, and the action was very different. That's what I liked about it. It was Spider-Man fought the way Spider-Man would. It was very fast. I'm going to have to study it. Iron Man fought the way Iron Man would. The Vulture was awesome.
Mm-hmm.
And also they fought in character, which is very important to me. I hate it the way on television shows and movies that as soon as they start fighting, they seem to completely forget who they are. They don't know who they are. They don't fight in character. They fight like something they saw, right? Or their instincts from watching too many John Wayne movies. They stop. They stop thinking also. They completely stop thinking. And here it was fun to see him, especially with his suit, because at first I didn't know what I felt about him having this super Iron Man-like suit, mm-hmm. complete with a AI in it, with the played by the voice of the AI from Iron Man, played by Jennifer Connelly, who's married to Paul Bettany. Yeah, the training program. But then I liked it because, again, he's learning. Throughout the whole movie, he's learning. Go ahead.
Another point that now that we talked about the AI thing, another point, maybe hair fatigue, maybe just like, just like tired of making excuses. The other thing is like, he's friend, he's in from high school, like he's like an Asian hacker.
Right.
Fine. How can he hack into Tony Stark, the man of the hour with technology? How can he hack into that fucking fast?
Like, I'm like a library computer too.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, go fuck yourself.
Yeah. I mean, I get it. Like,
I know what they're doing.
Only Tony Stark can hack into Tony Stark's thing that fast.
Yeah.
There's no way that a high schooler with a library computer.
But I mean,
computer.
Not for nothing. Like, again, like what Rick said, like my issues with this film are super minor. Like, I didn't.
But those major small points will lead changes to the actual.
It's true, but they made it up. They made up.
They're
trying to make it up with charm. They were trying to make it charming, and I found it very charming. Let me say also that that Ilram Choi, a Korean gentleman, or born originally, and his parents were born in Korea, was the fight choreographer. And he's a stunt guy, but he got promoted up for Kong Skull Island as the fight choreographer. And so he didn't do a bad job. He didn't have enough, you know, one of the problems with a lot of Korean movies, for me, is, of course, they have a very faulty, fairly ineffective, in quotes, national martial art, Taekwondo, where it's very difficult to actually use that accurately. And I find in a lot of choreography in general that they're using very generic mixed martial arts, which has a basis of jujitsu and taekwondo, so it doesn't really translate as powerful or valid or interesting fight scenes. But this one had good ones because, again, everybody fought in character and people were learning, and I liked it. And then George Cottle was the stunt coordinator who did a lot of Christopher Nolan movies, including Dark Knight, Inception, Interstellar, in addition to Kong the Land. So those are the guys who are responsible for it. And since we made the segue, do you want to move on or do you have more to say about Spider-Man?
I mean, I was to say, like, I kept hearing people say it was like a John Hughes movie, which I agree with.
Yes, another charm of it. The thing that thrilled me, I love moments in movies, especially since I grew up with Marvel Comics and I was there at the inception, if you'll excuse the expression, of Marvel Comics. I love it when there's something that harkens back to a childhood comic book highlight for me, and that was the issue of the 33rd issue of Spider-Man is a change. It's a game changer. It's where he truly comes into his own character, and the cover has him buried under machinery, and there's a very famous couple of pages in there that Steve Ditko drew where Spider-Man thinks he's done for, but finds his strength and lifts all the stuff off of himself, and that was recreated in this film.
Yeah.
So it's just like a moment like when Ant-Man became Giant-Man in Civil War that I just got thrilled. I just was, whoa, my boy!
I think Tom Holland, he was like bred in a lab to play this role. Like, he was perfect.
I mean, he's also
he's got, like,
acrobatic, too.
But he was a West End, like Broadway in England.
So.
But again, the ending was so great when, you know, they cut off of Aunt May.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, those wonderful credits. So, and even that wonderful, those two last end credit sequences.
Oh, where Iron Man show him the suit and he wouldn't take it? That's one of them.
Well, no, that was at the end of the movie.
Oh, that was
Captain
America.
The end credit is when back in jail with Michael Keaton.
Okay, but that was like, I also was like, why wouldn't he just say the name? Like, what does he care?
Because that's what I loved about it, because I loved Michael Keaton's acting in this. He was, to my mind, outside of like Adam West, he's the best Batman too, Michael Keaton. He's the best. I think I put him in the running for the best villain of the entire Marvel cinematic universe.
He was the
universe.
Most compelling, for sure.
He was the most
believable, and that's what I loved about it, because he was not a villain who wants to take over the world.
No.
He wants to make money, he's angry at the government and for Stark for screwing him over at the beginning, and he has a moral code.
Yeah, okay, though, I will say that is a thing that keeps happening, though, where, like, the villain is, like, at this point where we're, like, past the Avengers, so, like, all of the villains are, like, somehow affected by the Avengers.
Right, by the heroes.
Yeah.
Like the whole Civil War thing.
They have a personal thing.
It started because a woman confronted Tony Stark because her kid got killed, and then there was the explosions.
Right.
And it's all,
however,
it's like, it like self-perpetuates itself.
The villain in there was just a means to an end in the Avengers. But here in Spider-Man, one of the things I loved about that sequence was Michael Keaton's acting. Because I saw on his face, and they say that's the art of acting, showing the audience what you're thinking. I saw him go, maybe I will tell him, and then I saw him go, no. For two reasons. I counted two reasons. One, I, the Vulture, want to do it myself. And two, he saved my life and he saved my family.
No, that's what I figured.
So I just thought it was an awesome piece of work.
Speaking of villains, this isn't really a villain, but I really liked that I liked that the bully was also on, like, the...
Yeah, like the brain team.
Yeah, the brain team. Because I mean, I think it was like a tech school.
Yeah, because in the comic book, Flash Thompson... I was going to say Flash Gordon. Flash Thompson was a classic California white guy, blonde boy.
Yeah.
Blue-eyed.
I want to see more out of, they set up Zendaya to be more.
Oh, yeah. Well, she is a major, major character.
Oh, yeah, Mary Jane.
I feel like, that's like something, like for me, that's like extra towards the end. Like, I don't need to see that. You can
just
show me.
Well, for me, it was frustrating because they kept promoting this film, like, with the two of them. And I get that she's more famous than the main girl.
They were getting the Disney people, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But, like, she, like, didn't... She was, like, not, like... She just...
No. She's like the Wasp. Right now, a lot of the guys we're going to be talking today are working on Ant-Man and the Wasp, the sequel to Ant-Man. And that was, like, her and... That was, like, the Wasp in the original Ant-Man movie. They have a future.
Yeah.
We know where... Everybody's coming back.
Right.
There's no worries. Anyway. So what do you do? Something you want to do? One that I saw that you didn't see, or do you want to go right to? We've already mentioned.
No, we can. We'll go with something that you saw.
All right. Well, then let me get this out of the way. Atomic Blonde. What a disappointment! Did you guys see it?
I boycotted
it.
But why did you boycott it?
Because I heard that there's a scene where the one lesbian character gets
brutally
murdered halfway through the film, and I'm sick of shows just killing off the gay girl.
Yeah.
So we're done with that.
Well, you would have in quotes. I'm making air quotes. Watch me, everybody. I'm making air quotes. You would have loved this movie if you didn't go see it for that reason, because Atomic Blonde. It's directed by David Leitch, who was Brad Pitt's and Jean-Claude Van Damme's stunt double before he started working on stuff like John Wick. And he supposedly directed some sequences of the original John Wick, but he didn't get credit for it. But he's part of that team, part of that action team. And it was written by Kurt Johnstad, who was an assistant director in Key Grip. He was more famous as an assistant director in Key Grip than he was for his other screenplays, which included Act of Valor and 300 and the 300 sequel. But he wrote this. Sam Hargrave was the stunt coordinator, who was also did the same thing for Suicide Squad, Captain America: Civil War, and Wolf Warrior 2 of all two movies, which we'll get to a little later. And John Valera was the fight coordinator, who's did Thor Ragnarok. He did Triple X Return of Xander Cage, which we saw together. But he also did Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles Out of the Shadows, which he had made, you know, didn't work at all. So Atomic Blonde, what a great idea. Follows up on John Wick. It's the same general team who do John Wick Chapter 2, which I quite enjoy. Did you guys see John Wick Chapter 2?
Yes, I watched it.
Yeah, you saw it with me. Yeah. All right. I was quite enjoyable. So I thought this was going to be the blonde woman version of that.
It would have been cool if it was in the same universe.
It would have been,
super
cool, except, my gosh, here's the problem. They seem to really think that All right. I don't like movies which separate their action from the film. If you come out of a movie and you say, well, the action was good, then that's not a good movie. Because it can't, if you separate the action from the rest of the movie, like the movie made no sense at all, and that's very true of this one. I mean, as the movie goes on, and the double crosses become triple crosses, and it's one of the few movies I've ever seen where the triple crosses go back to being double crosses before they become quadruple crosses and quintuple crosses, and then one and a half crosses. They really did edit this with a shredder. But worse than that, after the shredder, then they tried to tape it back all together again. And they did it by saying 2 days before, 4 months later, 16 hours
sideways. Wait, while in the film?
During the film.
They're jumping back and forth.
A production call? Like, we need to come up with something?
I think so, because at the beginning of the movie... Again, this is another example like Birth of the Dragon, a movie where probably none of us are going to see.
No.
Where the coming attraction trailer is an exercise in deception, where they're trying kind of desperately to find out what the movie's actually about. And in Atomic Blonde, the preview was good. The preview tells you a very straightforward plot.
Yeah, I was intrigued. Because Charlize Theron, wouldn't you want to see her kick ass?
And they're showing the scenes where she's kicking ass.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But every time she kicks ass... it just comes out of left field, and it doesn't match up with the next thing that happens. But then again, it's hard to follow what the next thing that happens, because it was 4 months before, 2 months later, 13 hours, in a toilet, whatever. They just kept on doing this, kept on switching stuff up. And then by the middle of the film, the action scenes that you see in the preview, she uses a water hose to stop some guards. The scene that is the centerpiece of the preview, which I think believes starts the preview, where, someday this job is going to kill me, but not today. That's the last scene in the movie.
Oh.
That's the final scene in the film. So but by then she has gone through three complete personality changes. Not only is the plot really, by the middle of the movie, they seem proud that it's incomprehensible. They said, we're just going to own our incomprehensibility. It's not Atomic Blonde, it's Unexplainable Blonde.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but the action is still okay. It's pretty good.
It reminds me of Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy.
Yeah, but maybe that's what they were trying to do.
Mm-hmm.
But they weren't doing it well. And there's a big central action sequence that is... reminiscent of several staircase action sequences that have preceded it, specifically Daredevil on Netflix, mm-hmm. and Ip Man, I think, 3. Also, the Protector 2 or Ong Bak 2, where he goes up, or is that 3? No, I think it's 2. He goes up a staircase, and it's all very derivative of Jackie Chan, where he did a single shot fight scene. So mm-hmm. here they're trying to do a single shot fight scene, which is very tiring. There's the movie The Villainous, the North Korean film The Villainous, Hardcore Henry. All these movies are trying to replicate the effect of playing a video game. But the problem with having human beings replicating digital video game characters is that when they're a human being, whether you like it or not, you have to kind of identify with them, because you're also a human being and you know that this is getting very tiring. And there's no way these guys can really keep this kind of stuff up. But they do anyway, so it just becomes monotonal, derivative, wears you down. So, but Atomic Blonde makes it one thing worse, which is, in order for this fight scene to work as far as they're concerned, I don't know why they suddenly decided that we're going to show her as an incompetent punching bag. Her last 2 to 3 major fights, she was really good. She was smart. She was ahead of everybody, and she beat them handily. And in that last scene, which is the first scene in the preview, again, she's just Ms. Total Pro.
Mm-hmm.
And for some reason in this sequence, she can't do anything. It's not like she gets wounded.
Mm-hmm.
She just starts letting people beat her up. And at the end, they kind of make an excuse, because by the end of the movie, you find out she's a triple agent. She's not a double agent. She's a triple agent.
Okay.
She's, you know, they give the impression in the beginning of the movie, she's working for British intelligence. And then near the end of the movie, she actually could be a Russian mole or a German mole or an enemy mole. But at the end, it turns out she's an American agent who works with John Goodman. But it comes out of, like, nowhere. But then you think about the rest of the movie, and you say, what? It's like, I'm sorry I got really high there with my voice. But, yeah, I was sitting in the theater, like, I went, all right, so that's great. So they're laying the sequel out.
Yeah.
And she's going to working for John Goodman, who was great, James McAvoy was great. She was monotonal. She was just monotonal. But then the movie's trying to give her an excuse by saying, well, she's a triple agent, so she's playing everybody against everybody else. But it still doesn't explain why she let herself have the crap beat out of her in this awesome stairway sequence.
So what's her motivation on the film? Isn't it about a guy, like a partner?
Yeah, she had a lover who got killed by a low-level Russian. Well, that's not her motivation. Her motivation is that she... No, even that. She was given an assignment. Her assignment was to find out who killed that guy.
Okay.
And they find it out very quickly and take care of it very quickly. And then it becomes James McAvoy, spoiler alert, as if we didn't already sing the theme song. James McAvoy is the double agent. James McAvoy is the huge traitor. James McAvoy is the one who kills the lesbian in a very long fight scene where he gets stabbed twice by the lesbian in major parts of his body. But that doesn't stop him for a long time.
The Brother in Get Out.
It's just, yeah.
Like what?
It's
The Brother in Get Out.
Oh, The Brother in Get Out, the movie, which is an awesome movie.
I mean, it makes more sense
about
The Brother in Get Out, though.
So in any case, Atomic Blonde was a very big disappointment to me. Incomprehensible, incoherent blonde. Let's go on to something else. All right, we got a lot of choices. Wait a minute, I saw that, you didn't see that. We saw that, you want to do, we saw that. All right, so there's one, two... Three movies we did see together, or we all saw. We saw Valerian, War for the Planet of the Apes, and Dunkirk.
Yeah.
And there's three that I saw on my own. So what do you want to do?
We'll do the one that we've seen. So
Valerian, War of the Planet of the Apes, or Dunkirk.
Do you want to do a positive one or a negative one?
I don't really mind.
Well, let's do. I just did a negative one. So let's do a positive one, and then we'll do a negative.
Okay,
one.
Sure.
What's the positive one? Gosh.
Mika, what is the positive one?
Dunkirk.
I loved it.
Okay.
I loved it too. Did you love it, Jen?
I don't know.
That's an interesting answer.
Because part of it, honestly, like 15 minutes in, like I'm trying to separate, like, personal feelings from, like, the film, where it's, like...
It affected you.
Well, yeah. Well, like, honestly, like, 15 minutes in, I was kind of just, like, I don't want my heart rate to be this high for 2 hours. Like, honestly, and I was kind of like, you know what? I was like, war movies really upset me.
Yeah.
I was like, I'm thinking about, like, my dad and my grandpa in the Navy, and I was just like, do I really need to see this? Part of me is like, I know the history of Dunkirk. I'm like, I don't need to really see this and deal with this. Because I still, I remember when I saw Pearl Harbor.
Yeah.
Like, I always, like, that's the one scene where they're trying to drill the guy stuck in the submarine out.
Right.
And, like, the hands are sticking out of the thing and they all drown.
Yeah.
Like that. Yeah. I was just like, do I really need more of these moments in my memory?
But you're a filmmaker. You work at a studio.
I know, but that doesn't mean that I go for war films.
No, but you go for films.
Yeah.
And this is a magnificent film.
I've heard mixed things about it.
Yeah, but they're lying. The people who don't like this are finding ways not to like it because it really is a work of art.
I mean, for me, it was interesting because I ended up talking to somebody else at work. And, like, one of the kind of feelings, like, the itches that I had, it didn't affect my viewing of the movie.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, it was kind of just this thing where I was like, oh, like, this is kind of... Was the fact that, like, and I understand, like, they did this. Like, they focused on characters who were basically deserters.
Who are trying to be not being a noble.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So like for me, like I kind of had that where I was kind of like and it's like I understand like their need for survival. I understand the directors need to tell a more interesting story than like people who are kind of just on the beach sitting ducks, like trying to like find food and live and dodge bombs and stuff.
Right.
But I was also kind of just like, you all think you're better than all these other people, like, trying to escape, like, you know, this is, unfortunately, it's like you signed up for the military, or in this case, they were drafted, which also kind of is more like, I get why they would desert.
Right.
But I was kind of just like, these guys are doing all these, like, underhanded things to try to escape.
They were cheating. They were trying to cheat.
Well, they're also, like, young kids, too.
And also,
but
remember,
I understand that.
And I know they're the focal point, but it is a three-sectioned film, one about the flyers, one about the general, the generals, the officers.
Well, I mean, that part was completely negligible for me.
Well, not for me. I thought, I just loved watching Kenneth Branagh's face.
Well,
I mean, his acting
is so
good.
The plane fights.
The planes.
Yeah,
oh, yes. Oh, and Mark Rylance.
Tom Hardy's, like, plane fights, and then
and the boats.
The boats actually going towards, like, focusing on one boat, not just the whole thing, and then the actual event happened.
I mean, but that's the same thing where, like, the young boy who died on the boat, where it's like, I understood why, like, from a film point, like, I understood he represented, like, the civilians, where it's like, hey, this didn't just affect the military, this affected real people. And I feel like Miko and I kind of were aware of that more so because we had seen a film earlier this year, Their Finest, which focused on the civilian aspect of this war. And it was about them filming a propaganda film about Dunkirk as well. So I was like, I get why he died, but that doesn't mean that I liked it.
But he, not to say you should like it.
Yeah,
it affected you, but also that boy was a device with which to show the effect it had on the soldiers, because that had the, he died because a soldier went crazy because he was being brought back to this horrible place when he wanted to go home.
Yeah. So it's like, even just that, it's like, I totally understand why those
so
three characters
even
left.
Your complaints are wild compliments because this movie affected you deeply.
No, that's the thing, though, where it's like, I liked it. It's kind of like The Revenant, where I'm like, I really like this film. It was beautiful. I hated it because it was so upsetting, and I'm probably never going to watch it again, but it was amazing.
I'm able to step. You see, there's movies I don't go to, as you well know, like certain horror movies. I'm not going to be seeing Annabelle Creation anytime soon, because those things upset me, and that's not why I go to the cinema. Mm-hmm. But there are, one of the reasons I go to the cinema, outside of seeing movies that thrill me, and also, I movies that thrill me for different reasons. In the case of Dunkirk, it was just, as I said, I feel Christopher Nolan is one of the few true cinematic artists working today.
Mm-hmm.
It used to be David Lean. It used to be all sorts of great filmmakers. I can't think of Alfred Hitchcock. I mean, these were cinematic artists. And there are a lot of cinematic craftsmen right now who are awesome. They're not awesome, but they're doing really good work. Same thing in kung fu movies. I mean, La Ka Leong was pretty much the only real artist, and Ong Lee was an artist. Everybody else, Chang Che and everything, or Sammo Hung to a degree, are craftsmen. I'll see anything Christopher Nolan does, because he makes movies that can only be movies.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you couldn't make a play out of this script. Certainly for Memento and his other films, he couldn't do it. So I just thought it was amazing, and it had that effect, and it was well done and so smartly done. And the more you research, and you've done some research, the more wonderful things you find out.
Yeah. So one of the things, one of the things that the film made me feel is that my heart rate was up the whole film because the music, because
claustrophobia,
the whole thing. But one of the things that I found out recently is that throughout Christopher Nolan's film, especially in this one, Hans Zimmer has been the composer, not all of the film, but this one's Hans Zimmer, and they use a technique called Shepherd's Tone.
Mm-hmm.
And what that is it has three of the same music with different type of tonal pitch laying on top of each other, and you have the high pitch slowly goes out, you have the middle pitch goes consistently, and the low pitch slowly goes out, so it feels like an ever-ending ascent of tension, but it never hits the peak.
Yep.
It's just always going up. It's the weirdest thing when you because I listened to it, some of it online, and it just feels it's just like
you just want them to drop the bass.
Right. Not drop the bass. It just feels like it feels like this mountain that you're climbing and you never get to the peak.
Yep.
And that's the feeling that they have with the ticking, like you said, the ticking.
They
of
use
the
ticking.
Clock.
And we found out that was an actual watch.
His watch.
Right.
That was Nolan's watch.
Yeah. And, you know, that's again the artistry where he takes everything and uses it to create the feeling that he wants to create.
So yeah, with the music, your heart, it's just like getting cling on, like it grabs your heart and pulls you up, but it never lets you down. Like it never drops you, so you always feel that tension there, and that's what's
in
so
a great film. The color should do that, the sound should do, everything should do that, the editing should do it, and it all should be in one direction. And Christopher Nolan, and speaking of One Direction, that was a funny irony. I didn't know it was Harry Styles playing one of the young soldiers, and Harry Styles is, of course, from One Direction. And apparently Christopher Nolan didn't know it either.
Oh, yeah.
He cast him without knowing. He only found out later that, oh, this guy's one of the biggest music stars in the world.
You know, that's like the main Japanese actor from Letters from Iwo Jima.
Mm-hmm.
He's in like a big Japanese pop band over there, but Clint Eastwood just was like, he's the
good
guy.
Good actor.
And
he's
like,
the guy.
If you Google him, he's always in these crazy costumes, and you're just like, what the fuck?
Yeah.
Like his Oscar-worthy performance.
So for what?
I like that new guy, the main actor.
Oh yes, the young man.
Yeah. I'm so sad about the French guy.
Yeah, the French guy. That was upsetting. Definitely.
It'll be in the supplementals. You can look these guys up.
Yeah.
In for what it's worth, and it's worth a lot. Tom Struthers was the stunt coordinator who did the Dark Knight trilogy, Inception. And you know he's a Christopher Nolan guy, but he also did X-Men First Class, which was one of the better of the X-Men
movies. The only fight in this really was like the plane fight.
Well, you see, there were skirmishes throughout.
There's action, yeah.
This wasn't a fight coordinator.
Oh,
this was a stunt coordinator.
There
was a massive amount of stunts.
Yeah.
There was.
Because, again, Christopher Nolan wanted to do things real as opposed to
right.
I heard he did actual, like, matte paintings, like glass matte paintings for this.
He did that, and he also got some of the actual boats that were
used in the escape.
Right. Instead of just doing digital boats.
Yeah.
That's why I was hoping for that moment where...
I heard it was filmed, part of it was filmed on the actual...
Oh, yes. Oh, it was absolutely filmed in Dunkirk. And
that's scary.
I was waiting for that moment when Kenneth Branagh turns around and says... and sees the boats, and I was expecting that digital shot of hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of boats. But he just kept a couple, he just landed like a dozen there, because that's what he wanted to do real.
I'm assuming they also come in waves, too. So, like, that's the feeling you'll get.
Yeah.
Instead of seeing that grand, like...
Yeah.
Everyone
like
there.
The Lord of the Rings, Gandalf on the mountain.
Right. Yeah. It shouldn't be that feeling. It should be like, oh, they're coming. They're going to keep coming.
Another great thing about this movie is that even the people I've talked to who've complained about it, it really inspires you to learn more.
Mm-hmm.
To go out and read about Dunkirk as well as the making of the movie as well as the real incident.
I mean, the desperation on this film is definitely there because from the beginning of the film, again, like, it kicks off right away as the guys were running and getting shot at.
Right.
And you feel that tension there.
Yeah.
And then right away, when into a boat that has tons of injured people, a lot of nurses, a lot of medics, trying to bring them out. And immediately, the German came in, blew up the boat, sinks the whole thing. Hundreds of people just die right in front of people who are waiting at the boardwalk.
It really gives... You know, as I said in my initial Facebook review, it really gives the impression that war is not particularly pleasant.
That's what kills me, like, today. You have all these, like, militant groups, like, in this country, and, like, there's been a war going on for 17 years. How about you enlist in that one? But, like, you know, I think it was a good depiction, just because it's, like, I feel like, you know, there is, like, this certain amount of glamour
that we give to war
films. And I think this one was very good to be like, hey, you don't want this.
Yeah, this is, but then again, so social media, we won't get into this, of how it exists to agitate.
Mm-hmm.
So let's not, let me get agitated about something more important than that, which is, I might as well get this out of the way. Because
the Dark Tower?
No, not the Dark Tower. Nut Job 2. Nutty by Nature.
Jackie.
Well, you know, the guys...
You haven't even seen it.
No, I have.
I don't need to see it to know it's bad.
I'm going to withhold judgment.
Jackie, it's the fantastic monkey in Kung Fu Panda.
I have to ask you, he's also the teacher in the Lego Ninjago movie.
Right.
But I have to... And he's the best thing about Nut Job 2. I have to ask you, I want to ask you about, I know you hadn't seen it, that was the one reason I got a free ticket for my birthday. So I went to see The Big Sick which has no real action in it, which was delightful. And then, because it was late at night, I went over and I saw, oh, there's nobody at Nut Job 2. Literally, there was nobody at Nut Job 2.
You were
it was
the only
opening
one?
Night. I was the only
you
one in the theater.
Opening night?
Yes.
Oh, jeez.
Yes.
That's
there was
fantastic.
Nobody in the theater except me.
Wow, hater.
So, Cal Brunker.
Make good movies.
Have you ever heard of Cal Brunker?
I am not.
He's a storyboard artist, mostly. He got promoted to do Nut Job 1 and Nut Job 2, Nutty by Nature. And the writer is, along with Cal, was Bob Barlin, who hasn't written anything since 2001, but now is working with Cal. They're working on Nut Job 3 and Son of Bigfoot.
Oh, I saw a trailer for that.
Oh, jeez.
Okay, I'm sorry. That did not look very good.
No, well, this was not very good. As I said in my Facebook review.
Again, I have nothing against the artist. I'm assuming this is one of those things where the
Artist is not the problem.
The artist is always not the problem. It's always someone behind the back controlling it and making all the most important call, like set their foot down being like, we need a white rabbit, for example, in the film.
Right. Well, I don't think that's the issue here. I was going to say contrivance, thy name is Nut Job 2. That's what I said on Facebook. Because the problem with the movie, first of all, the credits make it fairly clear that it is a Korean production.
Okay.
And the Korean animator, and Lord knows the Korean animators have done so many television shows
We know people animated it in Canada.
Oh, in addition, well, that was one of the questions I wanted to ask you as well.
Because we know somebody who worked on it in Canada.
It had the same effect as Captain Underpants in that, but different. Captain Underpants actually had some imaginative things going on.
Mm.
There's nothing imaginative in Nut Job 2.
So what's the story?
The story is that these guys, these animals from the first one, who wound up being able to get into a nut factory at the end of the first movie, so they're set for life for their food, because one of the sloths didn't turn down the furnace, the nut factory explodes at the beginning of this one.
Okay.
So they decide they're going to go back to the park where they were, where they used to have to scavenge, and they'll go back to scavenging. But then this mayor, this fat, weird kind of character out of a bad James Bond film, mayor, or bad Dukes of Hazzard kind of show, decides he's going to create a amusement park there. And so they have to fight the amusement park guy, and they discover near the beginning of the movie that a bunch of mice had been pushed out of the park previously, and the head mouse is a thickly accented Bruce Lee trained mouse who, and Jackie, after all these years of trying to get out of Bruce's shadow, is pulled right back in by supplying the voice of this extremely cute mouse who doesn't like to be called cute. Now, if you guys were working, you're a story person, Jen, and you have a character who doesn't like to be called cute, do you think you might put in the story somewhere why he doesn't like to be called cute? Maybe something from his childhood or whatever. Well, the whole movie is a bunch of decisions that are made that they feel need no backing up at all.
Mm.
The mayor creates this amusement park, Liberty Land, I think it's called, to make money.
Right.
But he builds it as if he's creating the Towering Inferno. He purposely makes it into something that will fall apart because he doesn't care about anything. Therefore, you know, nothing adds up.
I have so many
nothing adds up.
Issues.
I mean, and they seem to have embraced the fact that nothing makes sense.
I mean, my first issue when you were like, oh, like they're going to go back, there's an amusement park. And I'm like, yo, every time I go to Six Flags, the wildlife there are set for life.
Yeah.
So a part of me is like, all the wildlife that, like, anytime you go to Disney World and you see the ducks, like, there, it's like they get, they're set. Like, there's always food. I was like, yo, if I was an animal, I would head for an amusement park. Maybe not if you're a rat. Obviously, that's, humans have an issue with rats, but they don't have an issue with squirrels.
Nothing's backed up.
Yeah, they don't have a issue with squirrels and dogs.
There's a lot of action. None of it holds up. None of it has any resonance. None of it has any interest. I would have loved to have had kids in the audience when I went to see it to see how they reacted, whether they got really quiet.
Did you laugh at all throughout the whole film?
No, the only thing that made me happy or made me smile, but then it made me sad, was the ending. Because instead of doing, Jackie Chan is famous for putting flubbed stunts and mistakes at the end of his films. So they have flubbed stunts and mistakes at the end credits of the mouse.
Okay.
But although they've done that, I think they did that on one of the Toy Stories.
Toy
Story 2, they had bloopers.
Yeah. Toy Story 2, the best with the bugs getting... Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, so here go see that movie instead of Nut Job 2. So they have the animated Jackie making mistakes, flubbing up this Bruce Lee 1-inch punch during the end credits. And then they cut to the live-action Jackie doing his lines. Not flubbing up, just showing him in the recording booth doing his lines.
Okay.
Oh, but that's cute.
That is cute.
You didn't like that?
No, I did like that, but then it made me sad because he's only in 3 scenes in the movie.
Oh.
So they're promoting him. Even the new posters are promoting him
as the main
as one of the stars. And also they have the one scene that was pretty cool was whenever he gets together with all the other mice. Because he's the leader of the mice.
Right.
So whenever the dozens or hundreds of mice show up on screen, backing him up, that's pretty cool. But it doesn't even come close to the wolves in Stork. The wolves in Storks are used cleverly. Here they're just used because, again, for whatever reason they can come up with, nothing in this movie makes sense.
That's a shame.
And nothing is effective. I can't decide which one is worse. Captain Underpants or this one, probably this one, because at least Captain Underpants had good intentions and had a source material that was valid. I was, as a matter of fact, talking about, I saw my nephew not too long ago, who's now a nurse at Mount Sinai in New York, and I said, remember I read the Captain Underpants? He goes, yeah, I remember that very well. How was the movie? Well, it was not as good as the book. So anyway, now, on to the next ones, which I guess, what do you want, War or Valerian?
Valerian.
You want to do...
Let's just sink lower, guys.
Oh,
let's sink all the way to the bottom and bring it back up at the end.
Let's do a deep dive.
Valerian and the City of a Thousand Planets, written and directed by Luc Besson, based on the bande dessinée, which is the word that they use for French comics, bande dessinée, by Pierre Christin and Jean-Claude Mézières. And they had a fight choreographer, of course, and a stunt coordinator, which was Laurent Demianoff. Laurent Demianoff, who also did The Transporter Reloaded and a bunch of French stuff. This is a French movie.
Right.
And my buddy Larry Hama, who was the great Marvel Comics guy, just a great comics guy in general, he said, you know, I remember the day when I finally read a translated French comic book. Who's the French... who's the most famous?
Mobius.
Mobius. He said, I've been looking at the Mobius comics for my entire life, and I finally read one translated. I couldn't believe how stupid it was. And apparently that's true also of this bande dessinée.
Well, this is like the most expensive indie film. That's what it says.
Oh, yeah.
It's a French. Well, it started well.
It started,
I'm like,
it started
really well. He finally got the rights to it. Yeah, I'd say it was like Fantastic Four, where you were like, why is everybody shitting on it? Oh, that's why. Like, you got, like, the first half hour, you're like, oh, that was cool.
Well, it's
cool,
like,
concept, and then you never see
this
it
is like
again.
This is like a very, like, it's like a diver
like a
walking to a boar and jumping up and down, and you're like, oh, it's good, and then bam, slam into
the
water.
A belly flop.
Yeah.
This was one of those films that I'll admit, while watching it, I was actively aware, I'm like, this is really bad. But I'm still going to try to enjoy it. And I did enjoy
visually,
it.
Visually, it was very enjoyable.
That.
It was so,
I'm
there's
telling
so
you.
Much in there.
But I think it was also, like, you, like, Rick, you're one of those people who you'll be like, oh, man, I was rewriting it and re-editing it in my head. And Miko, you're always like, oh, man, I would have done this. And I'm never, I don't try to do that. But this, I was like,
do it after the film,
no, though. I was like, this is one of those things where it's like, this is such, like, an old, well-known comic. And it's, like, for it to finally get put on screen. I think part of it, too, is, like... This comic set the tone, or like set the standard for so many sci-fi things to come.
Yeah.
That now that we're seeing it after Guardians, after all of these other things have come out, we're just like, okay, this is just a rehash of everything we've already seen.
I will give you odds that if I saw this in France with my French friends in Paris, And I saw it without subtitles. I had to go to it. I saw it with my friends, so they didn't have subtitles for stupid Americans. So it was just, if I had seen this movie without knowing what they said,
yeah.
I would have come back and said, you have got to see this movie.
Yeah.
This movie is so good. Because I would have supplied,
yeah.
I would have supplied what I think they were saying in my own head.
Yeah.
And no matter what you may think of my writing, people, if any of you have read my work, believe me, I would have come up with what better than what they had.
Yeah, some of it was just cringy.
It's so crammed into, like, there's so many stuff in there, it's so crammed.
But actually, I didn't mind that. I didn't mind, like, the universe being so big. I minded
anything they said.
No, I don't mind the universe being big. I mind being, like, amount of stuff in there and the pacing of it. Because, again, in the beginning, when they're doing the interior...
The initial, like, heist kind of thing.
Heist,
like,
yeah.
The multi-dimensional.
Oh, yeah. The multi-dimensional.
So awesome.
That was very interesting. That
very
was really, really cool.
Yeah.
I mean,
very good.
So it started with them going to this desert area where people...
Which isn't actually a desert area.
Right. Well, it is.
Well, it is a desert area.
In this world.
Right.
But you go through a sort of a semi of a portal, and you put on glasses, you put on some gloves, where you can touch actual stuff. Your holographic body actually can touch.
But it's three to four levels of reality.
Right, yeah. Right.
There was a point where, like, his body was in one dimension, or, like, in one location. Like, his arm was in another, and this box he had was in another.
Yeah.
And the way that they played, it was so fun.
And it held up.
It held up.
And you really thought, like, it was like, oh, man, like, the ending of this, I was like, if this is what they're setting us up with now, I was like, what the hell's the ending going to be?
Right.
Well, what happened was, as I said again on my Facebook review, how can a movie so advanced in visuals be so regressive in attitude, chauvinism?
Oh my God, yeah.
Stupidity.
I mean, wasn't going to do that. I wasn't on this. I was like, I can get started between Rihanna's character and, like, weird love.
Rihanna's
like,
character.
Oh, like his constant propositions for her to marry him. Like, I was just like,
that's,
what the fuck?
That's so unbelievable.
The title character is Valerian.
Yeah.
Who's a total a-hole.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's a chauvinistic a-hole.
Right.
And he's played by a lovely... Who's the actor?
I love Dane DeHaan.
Dane DeHaan.
So upset.
He just not that's just not his character.
When he was cast, I was like, this is perfect casting. Because he does play
and
that.
She's
that's
great.
The kind of character that he tends to play.
Right.
But, like, again, if I would have been... If they had made it to him trying to convince her to go on a first date... Like, that whole, like, I'm going to wear her down until she says yes, like, that's annoying, but I would have been more forgiving if it was a first date and not, like,
but
a marriage.
But I would have been more forgiving if he was likable.
Well, yeah, that's
true. Because I agree with Rick, because Rick said, when as soon as we came out of the movie, he said that the character, like, he just couldn't pull off that charm.
Yeah.
Like, you can be an
there
asshole.
There was no charm. They asked him to be a jerk.
Right. Well, you can be a jerk in a movie, an asshole in a movie.
But become a good guy.
Yeah, become a good guy.
Harrison Ford plays that
character
really well. Like, Harrison Ford's characters are always, like, kind of creepy, to be honest.
Yes.
But, like, you forget.
But he always had the charm. That's what I'm saying.
Same
character.
Michael Keaton, too. Look at Beetlejuice.
Yeah,
look at what Michael Keaton can do.
Does not have the charm.
What was the girl's Cara Devonier, I think?
Yeah,
she was awesome. It'll be on the supplemental.
Yeah, she's awesome, though.
She's awesome. And I think he's awesome, too, but he was... I guess he was playing the character from this bande dessinée, and I guess this character from the bande dessinée was a chauvinistic a-hole.
Mm-hmm.
I guess, but geez, they really should have known better. Maybe they could, because they're French, and they're doing it ostensibly for a French audience, they didn't feel they could update the character to a decent human being.
Yeah, well, that's what I was wondering, because I've only read, like, the first, one of my coworkers has, like, a bunch of, like, thin volumes of Valerian.
Yeah.
And I've only read a couple, and then I was like, oh, I'm going to see it anyway. So, like, I'm like, I want to go in fresh.
Yeah.
And, yeah, so now I'm like, was he... Like, again, it's an older comic, so you're more forgiving.
Right.
But it wasn't... I didn't get... It wasn't like he was a jerk. It was just like, oh, like, you're just an old man, basically.
Some of the things I liked about it from, you know, specifically this podcast's approach is that they weren't using bullets, which is nice.
Mm-hmm.
They had different weapons that had use. I mean, some guys were, but those were idiots.
So I was going to say, though, the bullets they use, like, well, how advanced this whole society is. Why are they shooting, like, damn bullets?
Well,
because
that was done by the evil white people. The evil white people love their bullets. So they were doing it while the aliens didn't use bullets.
No, the alien didn't, yes.
Yeah, so I kind of dug it. The only time there was any real fighting, per se, was a short mixed martial art sequence. So, you know, she got to kick around some guys, guards.
Yeah.
But again...
was that when they were going to chop her head off?
Like, that was,
no, that was not the chopping head.
Okay. She was, I think Rick was saying when she was trying to escape.
Yeah, when she was trying to escape.
That was pretty good. Yeah. But yeah, the chopping head off, that whole part when she gets kidnapped, that whole part could have been cut clean. It would have made
it had no effect.
Yeah, again, Rihanna's character,
but it was
she
for Rihanna.
For like a 6 minute strip scene.
It's for Rihanna?
Yeah, it was for Rihanna.
And then she dies 2 minutes later, and then they make it seem like they've been friends for years, and I'm like, you met each other like 2 hours ago.
Yeah, and also...
Like, she literally gave you a lap dance.
Yeah.
Like
she was literally like fan service and like unnecessary exposition.
So my recommendation...
That whole thing is just like chopped.
If you want to see a beautiful, beautiful movie, get the French DVD... Or Blu-ray. Definitely get the 4K Blu-ray.
Yeah.
Do not watch it in English. Do not have any English involved. I think you will enjoy it.
Mm. Also, the French cut might be a little different, too. I don't know how much would they change, but it might be.
All right, so let's see. Oh, yeah. All right, so do you want me to go darker? Or do you
want
me
go darker. Sink. Oh, speaking of a film that crammed so much in.
Yeah, Dark Tower.
There we go, that's
a segment. Now I don't
want to
see it.
Dark Tower, here's the deal.
Dark Tower.
And in order for this to come out, there's one of two things that could happen. There's a lot of press. Apparently, the studio knew they were in big trouble. So they started leaking all sorts of backstage machinations. There were articles appearing up to the week of the premiere about what a fustercluck this was behind the scenes. Huh. It was directed and written by Nikolaj Arcel, along with his Denmark associate, Anders Thomas Jensen. But then, apparently... when someone decided that they didn't want what he could do, they brought in Jeff Pinkner, who was mostly known for television writing on Fringe, Lost, and Alias. And this is personally fascinating to me, Akiva Goldsman.
Oh, Jesus.
Who wrote A Beautiful Mind and Fringe, but also a bunch of really bad stuff.
Why?
Transformers.
He wrote a bunch of really bad stuff.
And produced a bunch of bad stuff. But what's interesting to me now is prior to this, they talked about what a fustercluck it was during production. But after it came out, they threw Akiva Goldsman so hard under the bus, they created brand new double-decker buses to throw him under. There are so many articles coming out now on social media about he is the kiss of death. Goldsman's the kiss of death. He's the problem. He's the Zack Snyder of the Dark Tower. Well, he did the Transformers 5. Do you remember any other stuff?
I feel like I saw him. I don't know if it wasn't Gods of Egypt, but it was something like at that level where I was just like, why do you keep getting shots?
Gods of Egypt is above.
Well, there's a but they're shooting at him now. But I think... So the fact they're shooting so hard at him now makes me believe that he's really not to blame, and that they're covering up. It's the same way they did to Martin Campbell after Green Lantern.
I mean, he's probably partially to blame, but it's definitely there's other problems that if the studio's shitting on it, that means the studio's to blame.
Well, I am guessing
you're setting this. Again, I didn't even know this until after you saw it. The fact that they're trying to cram all 7 books into one film
in a 90-minute film.
How do you expect to succeed in any possible way with Stephen King? King of all authors, too.
And apparently, according to one of the articles, Stephen King had complete say.
Mm-hmm.
He was able to negate anything.
Really?
He has a podcast. I have to look it up. I'll try to put it on the supplemental, where he's going to talk about the making of the movie.
Wow.
I read about that, but I haven't gotten to it because things got really busy.
Yeah, I kept hearing people be like, now this is a different interpretation. Like, you know, it's kind of like adaptation. Oof. And, you know, you have to separate them, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, I understand that.
But 7 books?
But you don't do
that.
They
took 7 books. They took most of the first half or more, three quarters even, of the movie from the first 3 books.
Mm-hmm.
And again, like Birth of the Dragon, they didn't make it about... The series is called The Gunslinger.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't make it about the gunslinger.
They made it about the boy.
They made it about the boy. And the gunslinger...
What was their target audience then, if it's like this little 13-year-old kid?
Oh, yeah.
It's like a dark series.
What is it?
For me, Gunslinger should have been an HBO TV series.
That's what everybody agrees. Everybody agrees it should have been a cable, like, 7-episode or 7 movie or 7 season.
Yeah.
Because the books are extremely dense.
Yeah.
They're, you know, Stephen King's largely successful, I would say, attempt at a grand fantasy.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because when you, I've always said this about Stephen King, when you take Stephen King's amazing writing away from his plots, you are left, you know, just blinking in disbelief. Because if you look at the plots, they're absurd.
Yeah.
I mean, one of my favorites of his is Thinner. It's evil in a strawberry pie. I mean, you take away the plot from The Mist, the plots are ridiculous in many cases. And in the case of the Dark Tower specifically, this really gives Nut Job 2 a run for the money in the what the hell are you talking about department.
Yeah.
The powers he uses a gun, he doesn't kill with his hand. He kills with his heart. What? As Aunt May says at the end of Spider-Man Homecoming, what the? And nothing is backed up. Nothing is substantiated. The fight scenes, by the way, did I mention who the fight people were?
No.
Nathan Barris was the fight coordinator. And this guy can't get any luck because his other major credit was Resident Evil Final Chapter.
How was that?
Well, I did see it on the plane. I think just like the Dark Tower people.
Lost
words. I feel like you can't even speak.
They're looking at the audience and going, let's just see how much we can screw this up. We're going to screw this up on purpose because we can, and showing off.
That Rick saw it on the plane tells you how much the movie is.
Here you go. No, here's the deal. We have some very decent fight scenes and some very decent stunt people.
I wanted Idris Elba's film to do well.
We all did. But the Resident Evil... They literally, our heroine punches somebody in the face, and they cut it four times in the space of one punch.
One punch.
Not only by the time that one punch is over, it's a roundhouse punch. You've seen it from four angles, in four different directions, underneath or above it, and the whole movie's like this.
Like the Matrix of punches.
They're like going, you know, just because you can edit doesn't mean you should.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just like, it became farcical. By the end of the first fight, it became, you guys are just doing this on purpose. I don't know why. You may think it's cool, but it's not.
Mm.
Now, Dark Tower, again, is just everywhere. They had a great cast. They had great technical stuff, but it's all behind the scenes.
Did they have a great cast, though, with Matthew McConaughey?
Yeah. What do you got against Matthew McConaughey?
Honestly, just every time the trailer would go on, they'd be like, oh, like, he's a man who's, or like, he's even worse than the devil. And I'd be like, he's Matthew McConaughey.
Yeah, well, there's another thing. Yeah, that's it. That's the whole movie. It's kind of like in the preview, they're showing you all the crap. He was fine. Everybody, all the actors were fine.
Mm.
Even the kid was fine. I didn't want to like the kid because they made it about him. And I'm going, oh, please. But he was fine. It just, whatever
How
was happening behind the scenes.
The kid in the film.
You mean in the
book? Not nearly as important as the gunslinger.
Okay, so why is he the major focus then?
Because they decided they were going to screw over. You see, who did they think was going to go see this?
That's what I was asking.
Yeah, if they feature
it's gonna be
a young
King fan.
So like a young adult, then that
was
is attracting
that,
young
like,
adult
Was that fans? A response to casting, like the backlash of casting Idris Elba?
Who knows? Who knows?
I don't want to go down that path, but like you can't help but wonder.
Look, go to the supplementals, find out the name of that podcast with Stephen King is going to talk about this, and let's all listen to it.
Mm.
Meanwhile, Frank Hullett was the stunt coordinator, who is best known for Chappie.
Ah.
So,
Chappie wasn't mad.
But again, nothing. The movie was a terrible movie, but there may have been a good movie one day if it was 7 hours long. But 90 minutes, not so much. All right, we got one more that we all saw. Not together, but we all saw it. And that was Apocalypse Now, The Great Apescape, and Apesidus.
Uh-huh.
Otherwise known as...
War for the Planet of the Apes.
Yeah.
Well, go ahead, guys.
War for the... Bad Ape was the best character.
Oh, yeah.
I'm so glad Bad Ape didn't die.
Steve Zahn.
Bad Ape is the best character, but however, he's the least realistic-looking character, though, which is kind of
Actually, no. He was, like, really ugly, so I felt like he was the most realistic-looking. Like, chimpanzees, like, grown chimpanzees.
No, he's ugly-looking, but I'm saying the skin texture. From a CG standpoint, he wasn't that
You guys could talk about... Who you think the biggest star in this movie was? I will tell you.
I love Maurice.
I will tell you who's the biggest star in this movie.
Did you say Andy Serkis?
No, Weta.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, of course. I mean,
the job they did with this motion capture is like head and shoulders above anything I've ever seen.
Yeah, I think...
just amazing.
When the first film came out, it wasn't perfect.
No,
so it was fine. It had a good plot.
It had a very good story.
The second one came out.
It was also easier to shoot because the first one, Caesar was the only ape you really had a lot of close-ups with anyway.
Right.
So this was like ape-to-ape conversation, cutting you off. What are you going to do about it?
Let me finish. Okay, so the second one with the motion capture and the CG, it was amazing.
Yeah.
So the third one,
even more amazing.
It's a film that makes you forget you're looking at like CGI.
Well, yeah, it's like an animated film featuring what's Woody Harrelson.
Woody Harrelson.
Who has it? That is it makes you like care for these animals that's not actually there.
Well, what did I say earlier about the art of a great actor is to see what they're thinking. We're seeing what apes are thinking.
Yeah.
That's just
like
an astonishing accomplishment.
You're not actually thinking that this is a CGI film anymore. Yeah. You're actually enjoying the film for being...
I like that the film boiled down to like, hey, it doesn't matter who else is on the sidelines. Humans will just fuck each other up like with no help whatsoever.
That's also true. And nature.
I was like,
nature,
we deserve to die.
It's like, yes, humans fuck each other and nature comes over and crushes everyone.
I knew it was going to be successful because it has the same theme as the most successful movie of all time, which was Avatar.
Oh, I was like, Gone with the Wind?
No, the most successful monetarily is Avatar. And what's the theme of Avatar? The same one, which is humans kind of suck.
What was the fucking thing in Avatar?
Humans suck.
Unobtainium. What's the stupid name? Okay.
Awesome name. In retrospect, I think the whole thing was awesome.
Yeah, but
it was so wise.
I like this because I like that it was like...
You just made me realize.
What?
James Cameron is a combination of Christopher Nolan and Michael Bay.
Yeah.
He's the unholy child of those two filmmakers.
I don't know how he'd feel about hearing him be a child of these younger people.
Well, I love most of James Cameron's stuff. I absolutely adore for real reasons. Avatar I adore for different reasons. Same way with Titanic.
Like, this film has some of the same issues, like some of like the more like logic stuff. There's like scenes where the little girl is sneaking around this military base
and you're hilarious.
Like, how did nobody see you? This is not, there are spotlights 2 feet away from you.
Yeah,
and also they have the best, you know, they're supposedly at least a huge army of humans having their final stand. Nobody walks around and notices that there are holes in the ground with apes looking up.
Like, there were a couple moments in this where I was like, as much as I liked Bad Ape, and like, I get that, you know, he was meant to endear you to him.
That was very
like,
sweet.
I was kind of just like, are you not a war movie, or like, are you like a serious drama, or are you like a cartoony film? Like,
the moment the graffiti in the tunnel said
Apocalypse
Now, I went, this is exactly, they're just, Matt Reeves, who did The Dawn Up as well as Cloverfield, was the director.
I didn't read the credit.
That's all right. And Mark Baumbach, who wrote The Wolverine and Dawn of the Planet of the Apes and Live Free or Die Hard, was the writer. And Terry Notary was the stunt coordinator who did Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, as well as Tintin, another French, bad French translation of a bande dessinée. But what are you going to say?
Oh, I was going to say, up until that point, though, the whole movie was serious and it was well connected. Up until that ape, exactly where it is, like the ape apocalypse, everything just fall apart logically.
But yeah, as soon as they're like, we'll sneak into tunnels and we'll burrow and, you know, whatever, and you're like, okay.
But in a way, I supplied the rationale for all of that and enjoyed it anyway because
they're building
a wall, but the wall is nonsense. The wall is absurd.
Yeah, that's kind of dumb.
They were just torturing. They were just again, humans suck.
Yeah.
So it was all about how humans suck.
Because then the troops from the other side. Oh no, they came from the.
They came from the north.
Yeah.
Or whatever.
I was just trying to think about.
Came from Canada.
Yeah, but they were like on the same team, but then this branch broke away.
But it was still enjoyable.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And for me, the whole movie was just the motion, how brilliant the motion capture
was. Yeah, the only thing that bugged me, that, like, actually bugged me, was that they kind of set up a moment where Woody Harrelson's character sees Caesar's baby son kind of, like, acting, like, calling out to him. And I was like, oh shit, he's gonna do something. Like, it was kind of, they set this up and there was no payoff, which I did.
Yeah.
I don't, like, they don't always need that. Like, I really liked how they set up the one military guy who they free in the beginning.
Oh, yeah.
And I like how he just died very unceremoniously, because it's like, hey, that's what war is. War's not always this guy
also,
doing the right thing.
They always kind of tease him that he might be good, but he never is.
But I love that. Yeah. Like, I like,
oh, yeah,
that's
I love that too.
I appreciated about Get Out, too, where the whole time you're like, oh, well, at least there's, like, one good white character, and then she's an asshole.
Yeah.
And she dies.
She's the biggest
too.
Asshole.
And I like that in this, where it's like, oh, like you thought, like, I mean, yeah, there still is the little human girl, but like, I like that there was no good human.
The only, the other thing, and speaking again about the subject matter of our podcast, the thing that I was most disappointed with, I enjoyed the movie, but I was most disappointed in that the apes didn't fight like apes. Because if you've ever seen an ape fight, it's scary.
Yeah.
How incredible. And I wanted at the end the apes to go ape.
Ape shit.
Because, literally ape shit. Yeah, because they throw shit at one point, and again, we have a ridiculous guard who reacts to the shit, go, who did that? I'm going to open up and walk in amongst you.
Exactly.
I mean, really stupid.
Fucking.
But I would.
There's so many logical issues.
Yeah, my biggest disappointment was they never fought like apes. And if they had fought like apes, we would have been able to leave the theater like, with our mouths open and our eyes huge.
Honestly, if they fix those issues, like those logical issues, it's like the film, it's not a war film for sure, but it's such a good drama.
There's it's a good drama.
You feel so bad for
you just hate
apes.
Humans.
Yeah.
You're just like...
Humans
kill us all.
See, I don't even hate... See, the thing is,
kill
I don't even
all.
Hate it. No, no. See, I don't even hate it, the humans. I don't even hate Woody Harrelson's character because he did it... Because he like he has a purpose and he has a backstory behind that.
He saw Apocalypse Now and decided
to
live it out.
Yeah, like he had to kill his own kid. Like obviously he's crazy, but like he had to do that to save the rest of the people. So like I feel him in that
but you
moment.
Don't, if your community is undergoing this deadly disease, you don't like annex yourself from like the rest of like the military.
Well, that's how you do it. Or if you want to survive from like. The possibility of getting like
I mean
like,
I just felt like that like there wasn't a really that explanation like the actual
guys.
Human conflict wasn't very strong.
Oh yeah,
guys,
that wasn't for sure.
Guys, don't be talking logic for War of the Planet of the Apes. it's kind of a waste for you to be talking about logic.
But it's so like
it's a charming film.
The underlying
we liked
story
it.
Is so good though.
Yes, absolutely.
I mean, it was like to be honest though, it wasn't a very satisfying ending to this.
No.
Trilogy.
Oh, yeah.
No, it was kind of lame.
I'm like, okay, Caesar's dead. I'm like, so now what? Like, I don't, like,
no,
what are you going to do next?
It's over. In terms
and
of,
also,
like, the
but will they let it be over?
No, they're not going to let it be over.
They're not
so
going
well.
To be, yeah.
The part of me is like, are we going to suddenly shift to, like, the humans and then want to root for the humans? Because I'm not on that. I'm not on that.
I just want Charlton Heston coming off of that ship at some point.
Yeah. And I can't.
But that's what I'm like, where do we go from here?
Caesar's such a good character that it's hard to find anyone else to replace him.
We'll see. I mean, if you look at the original Planet of the Apes series, it had the same trajectory.
Yeah.
Okay. The first one was genius. The second one is campy genius. The third one is what? Mm-hmm. And the fourth one is like, okay. And then the fifth one, all right, we'll settle for that. It was basically a glorified TV movie. Mm-hmm. And they, well, let's see what they can do.
Okay, and then there's the Tim Burton remake.
Oh my gosh, let's not even.
Which, as a kid, I did like it.
Andrew Garfield.
As a kid, I liked it.
Andrew Garfield as Planet of the Apes. No. Anyway, so we're over an hour. Let me quickly talk about Wolf Warrior 2, and then let's go eat. Wolf Warrior 2.
Oh, we make decent time. As I delay it.
Wolf Warrior It'll 2 was Wolf Warrior 2 is a sequel to Wolf Warrior 1. It's a Chinese production. One of my favorite modern kung fu stars is a gentleman named Wu Jing, who was given the American Jackie Wu Jing. And he was from the same school as Jet Li. He's a real kung fu guy. He knows what he's doing. I've always liked him. He had a television series on, which was Yu Mu Ping directed it and created it. It was Master of Tai Chi. And it's one of the best uses of Tai Chi and Bagua ever in entertainment. It was originally on television. Tai Sang did a cut the 50-episode television series into a 2.5-hour movie, TV movie, basically. But it had awesome, awesome Tai Chi in it, and Wu Jing was great. Then Wu Jing showed his versatility by becoming the villain in the original SPL, a.k.a. Killzone, fighting Donnie Yen, and he's awesome in that. He's just an awesome star, and I've been waiting for him to become a huge star. But then the Hong Kong film industry collapsed. Donnie Yen took over as the king of Kung Fu, and it has been said, I don't know if it's true or not, that Donnie, once he ascended to the throne, started doing Hamlet-like things to keep other people from competing with him.
A man after my heart.
There you go. And so Wu Jing was kind of like, and then Wolf War, and then, of course, in 1997, the Chinese take back Hong Kong from the British. The lease runs out. The British lease on Hong Kong runs out. The Chinese take over, and suddenly all these free filmmakers are no longer free. They have to kowtow to the Chinese film bureaus. And so Wu Jing wasn't doing it. Was just kind of struggling after he did a he did SPL 2 or Kill Zone 2, and there was rumors then that, like Jet Li, he was going to retire, because he really put everything he had into that movie, and he and Tony Jaa, who co-stars in the film, were just like really injured at the end of it, and there was some thought that he would never be able to work again. So he comes out a couple of years ago with Wolf Warrior, which is a recruitment movie for the Chinese army. But
like officially or like it's obvious?
Well, it's obvious. It might as well be.
Yeah.
It isn't. It's a movie. It's an action movie about a Chinese army officer who is fighting bad people. But when you're an American and you're seeing a Chinese movie that does what John Wayne movies do, it's at first disconcerting.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of like, wow, this is awfully, you know,
propaganda.
Yeah. But then you go, well, wait a minute. If we were making this,
right,
Americans are the greatest and the Chinese are the villains. So,
it's like Red Dawn.
So, yeah. So I was watching it from... Wu Jing stars in it, wrote it, directed it. And he had Scott Adkins, who was a guest at my Kung Fu Extravaganza this year. And I was disappointed that they didn't do Kung Fu together. It was all guns, it was all grenades, it was all tanks, it was all militaristic. And when they had their final confrontation, it was just a lot of closed fists, anger and muscle-driven stuff. And I'm going, I know these guys can, both of these guys can do better than that. But it was enough as a success that Wolf Warrior 2 just came out. And I think I don't know if you know, it is now the most successful movie in China cinema history.
Really?
Oh, wow.
Yes. In the last 2 weeks, it has made more money. Well, we can look it up, because, you know, things can be exaggerated. But again, Wu Jing produced it, co-wrote it, stars in it, and directs it. And it takes place in Africa. And it is wildly patriotic. And he is sort of like drummed out of the Chinese army at the beginning. Mm-hmm. There's this amazing, again, it really bothers me, that really, there's always, the best fight is always at the beginning of the movie. And so he's a guy working on a freighter, and a bunch of pirates, Somali pirates, attack it. And he does an underwater fight scene with them that is really kind of awesome.
Great.
Just very clever. It really establishes his character beautifully.
And then nothing else happens.
No, lots happen. Lots and lots of things happen.
That's good.
Because he's dealing with a friend of mine, an Asian friend of mine, recently saw it, because it's all over America now, too. They're showing it. Welgo USA is showing it in all sorts of cinemas in New York and L.A. and all the rest of it. And he wrote, his tagline was, the Chinese Liberation Army versus Hydra.
Oh, my goodness.
Because Frank Grillo, who's the star of that MMA television show, The Kingdom, plays the villain in this one. Who winds up being the guy who kills his Wu Jing's girlfriend? What are we going to say? You
no,
recognize
I
the name?
Thought of your Facebook post.
Oh yes, that's right. Oh, there was an article. I forgot. Cinema Blend said that it was Frank Grillo's movie, and I'm going, Frank Grillo plays a part in a movie that Wu Jing stars in, wrote, directed, and produced. So don't say it's Frank Grillo's movie.
Yeah, they somehow whitewashed it.
To make
they
it.
They always find a way.
Yeah.
For having just like one like villain who happens to be white, and then they like focus on that as a main.
Yeah, as the guy who, they called it Frank Grillo's Wolf Warrior 2. It's like, it's so far away from that. But this movie mostly reminded me of The Last Rambo, because in The Last Rambo, he goes to Laos, and he deals with actual problems that happen in Laos.
Mm-hmm.
Wolf Warrior 2 is a grand propaganda action movie about how great China is, and the Chinese are, that takes place in Africa. And they do not sugarcoat the issue, what's going on in Africa. I mean, the Wolf Warrior character gets caught between rebels, some sort of Hydra-like organization run by Frank Grillo, who is shooting African despots right and left. Lots happened in this movie, and a lot of action. And what I really liked about it, again, the first Wolf Warrior was a kowtow, was Wu Jing saying to the Chinese government, I can be your boy. I do not have to do kung fu if you don't want me to. I can do the kind of movie that you want me to do. And he did. And so this one is even, like 1,000% more.
Is this one better than the first one?
Oh, absolutely. Oh, okay. Much better. And what I, again, I've been saying that virtually every movie made in China now, whether it's by a Chinese director or a Hong Kong director, is a very quiet act of defiance. Mm. They managed to put something in somewhere. I'm seeing how they're navigating. Because even though the Chinese directors have never grown up with the kind of freedom that the Hong Kong had for 100 years or 99 years, they still want to be free to create. Mm-hmm. Creative people, painters, artists, filmmakers want to create. Mm-hmm. And when they have somebody who's not creative over them saying, you can't do that, or you have to do what we say, mm-hmm. it's going to have an effect on the film. So watching all these new movies, especially with Wu Jing, again, he finally, comes into his own. So I'm seeing all these really lovely little kung fu touches. And it's usually in just the way his foot will move. In order to avoid a car crashing into a 7-Eleven in Africa, he has to get out of the way. And he does it in such a way that, yep, that's Wu Jing. Yep, there goes Wu Jing. Yep. So even though the confrontation at the end between him and Frank Grillo is mostly punching in the faces, it's still Wu Jing's movie. It's clearly Wu Jing's movie. And I will also say it's a lot of other people's movies. Dong Gun, Gao Yun, Lu Yi, all of who were writers on Chinese TV series helped him write the screenplay. The action director, now listen to this is great. I love this because, again, this is very smart of Wu Jing. The action director and fight coordinator and stunt coordinator is listed as Sam Hargrave. The action coordinator is Regis Harrington, who was a stuntman on Logan, Triple X, and Spider-Man Homecoming. The fight coordinator, who was a stuntman on Suicide Squad, was Thayer Harris. The stunt coordinator and Wu Jing's double was Brian Ho, who worked on the Marco Polo Netflix series. The fight choreographer stunt driver, who worked on Power Rangers, was Aaron Tony. That's everyone who's listed. And then, at the last possible second, they say that the action director was Jack Wai Lung Wong. And I said, yeah, that guy and Wu Jing, they did this. Mm-hmm. Everybody else was brought in and probably helped enormously because there's a lot of stunts in this.
Mm-hmm.
Lots and lots and lots of fights and stunts. And heavy, heavy action. It goes on, probably goes on for about, a half an hour too long. But it doesn't matter because it is such, I can practically see Wu Jing going, yeah, mm-hmm. jumping up and down going, yeah. And I've been waiting for him to take his place as the king. And now he's king. Most successful of all time. But hilariously propagandistic. At the end of the movie, he's finally gotten out of the bunch of innocent people out of the horrible war zone, but they're coming up to another band of African rebels versus government forces, and they're all about to be shot until he takes a Chinese flag and puts it on his arm and raises his arm as if his arm is the stick with the flag on the truck, and they drive through the rebels and the government people with the government people and the rebels cheering. And at one point, one of them says, oh, it's the Chinese. Don't shoot them. It's the Chinese. And he's on top of the thing, holding his arm up with the Chinese flag emblazoned as he goes. And the last thing in the movie is when, the end, and they have the credit sequence starts, they have this big shot of a Chinese passport. And as you're looking at this Chinese passport,
it's a closed Chinese passport.
It's a closed Chinese passport. But on the cover of the Chinese passport, as if an invisible hand is doing calligraphy,
mm-hmm.
Chinese lettering is being done. Now, I saw this at the AMC Empire 25 in New York as the only Guailo in the audience. And I turned to the person next to me, who was a lovely Chinese person, and says, what does that say? And he says, even if you're in a foreign country, the Chinese government got your back.
Beautiful.
And I went, yeah.
See, all you
did
need to
that do person say it in like a joke, like a laughing way, or where they just told you?
They just told me.
No, I said, well, what does it say? And he says, well, that's basically. And they were very nice.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I was sure if they were just
so
like.
So the lesson here is to always bring a Chinese flag to Africa.
And always bring a Chinese to Africa, specifically Wu Jing, if you can get it. So anyway, that's it. And oh, we got something new for the end of the show. As you know, we have my tagline.
Yes.
But I want you guys to do a callback. Not a callback. What's it called? When I say something and you say something back, like when I say Friday, you say party. What is that called?
I don't know.
A shout back or whatever it's called?
Yeah.
All right, I want you to do a shout back or whatever that's called.
Gosh.
So when I say the tagline, you say the return tagline, which is chew your fucking food, Rick.
Oh, yeah.
Okay? Can you do that?
Yeah. Sure.
Here we go. So ready, everybody. Thank you so much for listening. We'll see you in 2 weeks, I hope. And until then, use your blinkers, jackass.
Okay, break it up. Break it up. For now.
You don't give up, do you?
Listen in next time for more Film Fun, Frenzy, and Friends. Until then, check out actionfilmautopsy.com, where the excitement never ends.
Sonic.